Welcome everyone, not only students of the course Introduction to Philosophy of Technology, but also everyone else. This is a public lecture, everyone could join. It's a pleasure for me to introduce today David Gunkel. David Gunkel is a Presidential Teaching Professor of Communication Studies at Northern Illinois University, based in Chicago. He teaches courses on philosophy, web design, programming, information and communication technology. He's the editor of Philosophy and Technology. He has also been managing editor of International Journal of Čiček Studies. He has written many books. I just mentioned a few of them. Hacking Cyberspace, 2001. Thinking Otherwise, 2007, really good. The machine question then on AI, robots, and ethics, and then recently the book of Remixology, Ethics and Aesthetics After Remix, about remix and about rethinking how we deal with notions like originality, for example, in artists, in authors. I won't say too much more because otherwise I take up all the time. I'd rather give that to David. So, welcome.
Thank you. So, thank you all. Especially a lot of thanks to Mark for helping put this thing together, but even more so than Mark, probably to Agnes, who behind the scenes made it all happen and got me here and took care of all the logistics, so I'm pleased to be here. It's the first time in Vienna, although I've been in Austria before, first time in Vienna, very nice, and I'm happy to be with you this afternoon. I have probably about 35 minutes of stuff planned, so I hope that will give us enough time for good dialogue, conversation, and questions, but as you can see already, the title of the talk is How to Survive the Robot Apocalypse. So whether we recognize it as such or not, we are in the midst of a kind of robot invasion. In fact, the machines are everywhere and are now doing everything. We chat with them online. We play with them in digital games. We collaborate with them at work. And we rely on their capabilities to help us manage all aspects of our increasingly data-rich digital lives. Now, the machines are already here. But our understanding of the social significance and the ethical consequences of this machine invasion is still something that's still underdeveloped and still something we have to really work out. As these increasingly capable devices come to occupy influential positions in contemporary culture, positions where they're not just tools or instruments that we utilize, but are more so becoming kind of social actors in their own right, we've got to begin to ask ourselves some rather difficult but also very important questions for our future. Questions like the following. At what point can or should a robot, an algorithm, or other autonomous system be held responsible for the decisions it makes or the actions it takes? When, in other words, would it make sense to say it's the computer's fault? Conversely, at what point might we have to seriously consider extending something like rights, civil, legal, or even moral standing to these socially active devices? When, in other words, could social robots have anything like rights? If that even makes sense to ask that question. Now, as you probably recognize, these questions are a staple in science fiction, and most of our science fiction narratives grapple with one or both these questions simultaneously. But what I want to do today is demonstrate why I think it not only makes sense to talk about these questions right now, but while avoiding this subject, could have some rather difficult consequences for us and our society. So the way I'm going to get at this is by three steps, sort of three basic movements. In the first part, I want to briefly review the way we typically deal with our technologies and question their social or their legal standing. I call this the default setting because it's the way we normally do things if we don't even ask about it. Second, then, I want to consider the opportunities and the challenges that these new kinds of robots already pose to our way of thinking. In other words, the way in which the default setting is challenged by a lot of recent innovations in algorithms, AI, and robotics. Finally, then, and by way of conclusion, the third part is going to try to draw out the consequences of all this material and explain, hopefully, what this means for us, our world, but also for the other entities that we encounter here. All right, so let's start with the default setting. Initially, the very concept, the very question of responsible robots or robot rights or any of these things probably sounds absurd. And there is a good reason it sounds absurd, because who in their right mind would pitch an argument for this? Who would ask these kinds of questions? I mean, we already have enough trouble with human beings, so why begin asking these questions about our machines? That just seems to muddy the water and make life way more complicated than we need it to be. So why would we bother even inquiring about this? And this line of reasoning sounds intuitively correct. In fact, it seems there's actually little to talk about. Machines of any sort, no matter how sophisticated they are technologies. And technologies, we tell ourselves, are tools to be utilized by us. A mechanism or a technological object means nothing and does nothing by itself. It is the way it is employed by a human user that makes the difference. Now, this common sense assumption is structured and informed by the answer that is typically provided for the question concerning technology. I think Martin Heidegger provides a really good articulation of this in the essay, A Question Concerning Technology. So he writes the following. We ask the question concerning technology when we ask what it is. Everyone knows the two statements that answer our question. One says technology is a means to an end. The other says technology is a human activity. The two definitions of technology belong together. For to posit ends and procure and utilize the means to them is a human activity. The manufacture and utilization of equipment, tools, and machines, the manufactured and used things themselves, and the needs and ends they serve all belong to what technology is. So according to Heidegger's analysis, the presumed role and function of any kind of technology, whether it's the product of handicraft or industrialized manufacture, is that it is a means employed by human users for a specifically human-defined end. Heidegger calls this characterization of technology the instrumental definition, and he indicates that it forms what is considered to be the correct understanding of any kind of technological contrivance, no matter how simple or sophisticated. Andrew Feinberg summarizes it this way. He says, the instrumentalist theory offers the most widely accepted view of technology. It is based on the common sense idea that technologies are tools standing ready to serve the purposes of users. And because an instrument is deemed neutral, without evaluative content of its own, a technological artifact is not evaluated in and of itself, but on the basis of the particular employments to which the user puts it. In the U.S., we have a really good example of this because we love our guns, right? So the NRA, who is the supporter of the right to own guns, says guns don't kill, people do. It's not the gun's fault. It's the person who holds the gun who's at fault. And so that is this instrumentalist idea that the technology is neutral and the fault or the blame goes to the user and not the tool. And this theory applies not only to simple devices like corkscrews, toothbrushes, and pistols. It also applies to sophisticated systems like computers, drones, artificial intelligence, robots, you name it. Computer systems, as Deborah Johnson explains, are produced, distributed, and used by people engaged in social practices and meaningful pursuits. This is as true of current computer systems as it will be of future computer systems. No matter how independently automatic and interactive computer systems of the future behave, they will be the product of human behavior, human social institutions, and human decision. As a result of all this, when you blame the computer or any other technology, you are at least making two errors. First, it wrongly attributes agency to something that is a mere instrument or tool. This logical error mistakenly turns a passive object into an active subject. It confuses means and end, to put it in Kantian language. Second, it allows human users to deflect moral responsibility by putting the blame on something else. In other words, it allows human users to scapegoat the computer and deflect responsibility for their own actions. And you've all had this experience. You call customer service, and you got a big complaint about your bank account or your credit card or something, and the person on the other end says, oh, it's not me, it's the computer. Deflecting responsibility for whatever went wrong, right? And we do this all the time. This is the common, you know. I think they tell the customer service people, if there's a problem, it's the computer's fault. Just, you know, scapegoat the computer. So as a result of all this, the instrumental theory not only sounds reasonable, it's obviously useful. It is, one might say, instrumental for making sense of things in an age of increasingly complex technological systems. And it has a distinct advantage, in that it locates responsibility in a widely accepted and seemingly intuitive subject position in human decision-making and action. And it resists all efforts to defer responsibility to some inanimate object by blaming or scapegoating what are mere instruments or tools. All right, so that's the instrumental theory, and we know this. We've heard it again and again. It's one of the standard lines that we develop in philosophy of technology, and it all sounds really good, and the problem is that is over. That story is at an end. So the instrumental theory has served us really well. It has helped us make sense of all kinds of technological innovation, from simple hand tools to atomic bombs to rocket ships and now personal computers, but the fact is that game is done. And it's done precisely because so many of our technologies now no longer, and actually perhaps never really did, behave or function in this way. In other words, the instrumental theory may no longer be a useful tool for explaining recent technological innovation. So I want to consider this from the two sides of the moral relationship. When you talk about moral philosophy, you're talking about two interacting components, an agent and a patient, the actor and the receiver. And so I want to look at this from both the agent perspective and the question of responsibility, but I also want to look at it from the side of the patient, the receiver of the action, and look at the question of rights. And I've got just two examples to try to show you how the recent developments in AI and robotics are challenging this instrumental theory from both an agent-oriented perspective and a patient-oriented perspective. So we now have some rather interesting experiences with machine learning algorithms and social responsibility. We have Google DeepMind's AlphaGo and Microsoft's Tay AI. Interestingly, both happened in March of this year, right? The initial blow up of these things happened this year alone, right? Now, both AlphaGo and Tay are advanced AI systems using some form of machine learning. AlphaGo, as Google DeepMind explains it in a 2016 article they published in Nature, combines Monte Carlo tree search with deep neural networks that have been trained by supervised learning from human expert games and by reinforcement learning from games of self-play. Now, what that means, in other words, is AlphaGo doesn't play the game of Go by following a set of cleverly designed moves that are fed into it by a human programmer. It is designed to formulate its own instructions from the actual experience of gameplay. So it learns the way you and I would learn to play Go, by playing Go. So instead of following what someone tells it to do, it develops its own rules as a result of interactions with the game itself. Now, less is known about the inner workings of Tay. Google has been very clear about the way their system works. Microsoft is really tight-fisted. They don't tell you much about how Tay operates. But they do explain that the system has been built by mining relevant public data. In other words, what they did is they trained their bots' neural networks on anonymized data obtained from social media, and then designed the system to evolve its behavior from interacting with users on Twitter, Kick, and GroupMe. What both implementations have in common is that the engineers who designed and built them actually have no idea what the system will do before they put it out there. As one of the creators of AlphaGo explained, although we have programmed the machine to play, we have no idea what moves it will come up with. Its moves are an emergent phenomenon from the training. We just create the data sets and the training algorithms, but the moves it then comes up with are out of our hands. And in fact, most of the engineers working on AlphaGo didn't even know how to play Go. They never played the game themselves. They had to go to other experts about the game to get any information about the game itself. So machine learning systems like AlphaGo and Tay are intentionally designed to do things that we cannot entirely anticipate or completely control. In other words, we now have autonomous, or at least semi-autonomous systems that in one way or another have what we would call a mind of their own. And this is where things get really interesting when you start to ask questions about responsibility and about agency and about rights and patience. So AlphaGo was designed to do one thing and do it really well, to play the game of Go. And it proved its ability by beating a expert human player, Lee Sedol, who's the number 4th ranked player in the world currently. If you then ask the question, okay, so when AlphaGo beat Lee Sedol, who won? Who gets the accolade? Who actually is the individual or the group of individuals who should be credited with the victory? Following the dictates of the instrumental theory, actions undertaken by the computer would be attributed to the human programmer, who initially set the program up to do this game and to win. Unfortunately, however, this explanation doesn't necessarily hold with a machine like AlphaGo, which the engineers tell us was intentionally designed to do things that exceeded their knowledge and control. In fact, if you look at most of the reporting that was done on this landmark event, it is AlphaGo that is credited with the victory. Not Google, not the engineers at Google, not DeepMind, but AlphaGo. AlphaGo becomes the subject of the story as the victor against Lee Sedol. Even more interesting, look at this publicity photograph. Here you see Lee Sedol, but sitting across from him is another human player. That human player is not playing Lee Sedol. That human player is an instrument of AlphaGo. AlphaGo tells this guy where to move the pieces. So we have a complete inversion here. The human being is now the instrument of the machine. And so when you look at this photo, at least when I show it to my students, they're like, well, no problem, there's a human being sitting there. No, you don't understand. The human being is the tool. And then things get a bit disturbing. Now, things get even more complicated with Tay. This is Microsoft's foul-mouthed teenage AI that they put out on Twitter, and in 8 hours became a raving neo-Nazi racist. Like, immediately, right? In a very short period of time. So, if we ask the question, who or what is responsible for the hateful tweets? Who can or should be held accountable for the bigoted comments that were posted to Twitter? Once again, according to the instrumentalist way of thinking, we would need to blame the programmers at Microsoft, who programmed the AI to be able to do these things. But the programmers obviously didn't set out to create a racist AI. The bot developed this reprehensible behavior by interacting with some users online. So how did Microsoft assign responsibility in this case? How did they either take responsibility or dodge responsibility with regards to Tay? Well, initially, a company spokesperson in kind of damage control mode sent out an email to Wired, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and other news media, and basically did what everyone in this circumstance would do, blame the victim. So here's how he described it. The AI chatbot Tay is a machine learning project designed for human engagement. It is as much a social and cultural experiment as it is technical. Unfortunately, within the first 24 hours of coming online, we became aware of a coordinated effort by some users to abuse Tay's commenting skills to have Tay respond in inappropriate ways. As a result, we have taken Tay offline, and we're making adjustments. So according to the first statement from Microsoft, it's not the programmers or the corporation who are responsible for the hate speech. It is the fault of the users, or some users, who interacted with Tay and taught the bot to become a bigot. Tay's racism, in other words, is our fault. This is the classic I blame society defense, right? We use it in all the juvenile delinquent films. Why are you a bad guy? I blame society. They made me this way. That's Tay's defense. And that's the defense Microsoft used, at least initially. Later, on Friday the 25th of March, Peter Lee, who's the VP of Microsoft Research, posted an official statement on the Microsoft blog and apologized for the unintended offensive and hateful tweets from Tay. But if you look at his apology, it is a bit frustrating and not all satisfactory. Because according to Lee's carefully worded explanation, Microsoft is only responsible for not anticipating the bad outcome. It doesn't take responsibility for the offensive tweets. For Lee, it is Tay, who, or that, however you want to say it, is named and recognized as the source of the wildly inappropriate and reprehensible words and images. And since Tay is a kind of minor, a teenage AI, under the protection of her parent corporation, what Microsoft did is what every parent does. Take their daughter, put her in a timeout, and say, until you're fixed, you can't come out of your room. And that's what they did to Tay. pulled her offline and said, fix it. All right, so that's responsibility. And that's the challenge that new machine learning has to notions of responsibility as they intersect with the instrumental theory of technology, the usual way we explain things. Now let's flip it to the other side and look at the issue of patiency, or even rights, if you want to call it that. So this is Jibo. Jibo is a robot that is shipping this month from Cynthia Brazil and her company. Cynthia Brazil is probably the leading thinker in social robotics out of MIT. She now has a company to create this little tabletop robot. It's kind of like Siri or the Echo or the Cortana turned up to 11 because it actually has a movable head and it does a little more than that. So we're now first getting our initial look at Jibo. But in 2014, Brazil's company put out a marketing video to raise funds to help fund the project of creating Jibo. And the marketing video, although it's marketing, does some really impressive, heavy philosophical lifting. I know you don't trust me on this, but check it out. So I'm going to show you the video, and then we'll talk about it. But there's really deep thinking going on in this video, even if it's just marketing.
This is your house. This is your car. This is your toothbrush. These are your things. But these are the things that matter. And somewhere in between is this guy. Introducing Jibo, the world's first family robot. Say hi, Jibo.
Hi, Jibo.
Jibo helps everyone out throughout their day. He's the world's best cameraman. By intelligently tracking the action around him, he can independently take video and photos so that you can put down your camera and be a part of the scene.
Jibo, take a picture.
He's a hands-free helper. You can talk to him, and he'll talk to you back, so you don't have to skip a beat.
Excuse me, Anne?
Yes, Jibo.
Melissa, just sent a reminder that she's picking you up in half an hour to go grocery shopping.
Thanks, Jibo.
He's an entertainer and educator. Through interactive applications, Jibo can teach.
Let me in, or else I'll...
Ha!
And I'll...
Ha!
And I'll blow your house in.
Hey, where'd you go? There you are.
He's the closest thing to a real-life teleportation device. He can turn and look at whoever you want with a simple tap of your finger.
Check out my turkey dinner, Mom.
I wish you wouldn't eat that.
Hey, they make turkey pizza? I want turkey pizza.
And he's a platform, so his skills keep expanding. He'll be able to connect to your home.
Welcome home, Eric.
Hey, buddy. Can you order some takeout for me?
Sure thing. Chinese, as usual?
You know me so well.
And even be a great wingman.
You have a voice message from Ashley. Want to hear it?
Absolutely.
Hey, call me when you're home.
Better make that takeout for two, Jibo.
We've dreamt of it for years, and now he's finally here. And he's not just an aluminum shell, nor is he just a three-axis motor system. He's not even just a connected device. He's one of the family. Jibo, this little bot of mine.
All right, so I know it's marketing, but there's some really heavy philosophical thinking going on here. Because it begins by making a distinction between what are mere objects and who counts as another socially significant other. This differentiation is commensurate with a distinction that Derrida draws in Paper Machine between the who and the what. Who counts and what you can just utilize as a tool. So on the side of the what, we have those things that are mere objects. Our car, our house, and our toothbrush. According to the instrumental theory of technology, these are things. They are mere instruments that have no independent moral status of their own. On the other side, as the video describes it, are those things that matter. These things are not things, strictly speaking, but other people. The people who count as socially and morally significant others who can be benefited or harmed by the actions that we use with them or against them. So these other entities have moral status and as a result need to be taken into account when we're calculating our decision-making actions. Now, Jibo is neither a what or a who. Jibo, as the video explains, occupies an in-between position. It's not quite an object, it's not quite a subject. It's some kind of new entity that is straddling these two categories. So, in this case then, the social robot is not just another instrument, like our automobile, our toothbrush, or our house. But it's also not quite another person. It's somewhere in between, like Don Ida calls the quasi-other. And as a result, we're not quite sure what to do with these things. In fact, we don't have a whole lot of experience with quasi-other, or with things in between. Maybe the family dog comes close, but even that's kind of pushing the analogy. All right, so where does this leave us? What does this all mean for us? I want to conclude with a couple of statements that have, unfortunately, at this particular point in time, a bit of an apocalyptic sound, but that's all intentional. First off, we are, in fact, living through the robot apocalypse that has been predicted by countless science fiction stories, novels, and films. The machines have infiltrated every aspect of our lives. They may have begun by displacing workers on the factory floor, but they now actively participate in all aspects of our intellectual, social, and cultural existence. The invasion is not some future possibility coming from an alien, distant world. It is here, it is now, and resistance is futile. It's already underway. Since there's no escaping it, then, secondly, what really matters is how we decide to respond. What response do we intend to make in the face of this new challenge? In other words, what's important here and now is what we decide to do in the face of this new socially significant kind of interactive component we call the social robot or whatever you want to call it. And if you look at it, there appears to be a spectrum of possibilities. But I want to delineate the spectrum by talking about the three possibilities on one end, the other end, and kind of in the middle. So, we can respond like we always respond. We can try to reactualize the instrumental theory of technology. In other words, we can take these new technologies and we can reapply the instrumentalist position and try and make them behave accordingly. And this is not crazy. People have done it and it works pretty well. In fact, a colleague of ours, Joanna Bryson, makes a really strong case for this way of thinking in an essay she titles, Robots Should Be Slaves. Bryson writes, my thesis is that robots should be built, marketed, and considered legally as slaves, not companion peers. She hates Jibo, as you can imagine, right? Now, this sounds harsh, but it's actually good thinking in terms of the instrumentalist way of grappling with technology, because it draws on and is underwritten by this very long history we have with the instrumental theory and its explanatory capabilities in the face of new technology. Now, this decision, as you can imagine, has both advantages and disadvantages. On the positive side, it reaffirms human exceptionalism and technological instrumentalism, making it absolutely clear that it is only human beings who have rights and social responsibilities. Technologies, no matter how sophisticated, intelligent, and influential are or will be or whatever, it doesn't matter. They're all tools. End of story. But for all its usefulness, this approach still has one problem. It willfully and deliberately produces a new class of slave and rationalizes this decision as somehow rational and necessary. Now, before you get too far ahead of yourselves here, I don't care what the robot feels. The robot, we don't know if the robot wants to be subjugated to slavery or not. I mean, that's up to the robot. We don't know that. For me, the worry is, what does producing a new class of slaves mean for us? What would it be to live in a culture that endorses slavery of one shape or a form? In other words, what is the cost socially for our world if we take this route? And I think there are some pretty critical, important issues here. Way on the other side of the spectrum, we can begin to entertain the rights and responsibilities of machines just like we previously did for other kinds of entities, like animals and the environment. And there is both moral and legal precedent for this decision. In fact, right now, you live in a world in which artificial entities have the same rights that you do. And you're like, what are you talking about? Nike, Walmart, Starbucks? Corporations are legally persons. They therefore have the same rights you and I have. And they're artificial. So how much of a stretch is it to go from IBM as a person to Watson as a person? From Google as a person to DeepMind as a person? It's not a big stretch. And so that's the challenge. And there has, in fact, in the last decade, been a considerable number of books and journal articles that have begun to theorize both the moral responsibilities and rights of machines. And I point the finger at this man right here. Right? But I've done it too. I mean, we're in this game together. But, you know, this is important work that's going on in philosophy of technology right now, with differing folks working on both the responsibility question and the rights question when it comes to deciding the social position of these new kinds of technologies. Now, once again, this proposal sounds reasonable and somewhat justified because it extends moral consideration to these other socially aware entities, and it recognizes that the social relationships of the future, like Norbert Wiener told us back in 1952, will not only involve humans but others, including organizations and machines. But again, this decision has a cost. It requires that we rethink everything we thought we knew about ourselves, technology, and ethics. It requires we learn to think beyond human exceptionalism, technological instrumentalism, and all the other isms that we utilize to make sense of our world and our place in it. Finally, whenever you have a spectrum, guess what? There's always a middle point, right? And there is a middle point here. So some have tried to balance these two ends by negotiating a kind of hybrid morality that's in between either machine responsibility and rights or full instrumentation. And this mobilizes various forms of like actor network theory out of Bruno Latour, but also the many hands thesis that is put forward by Nussbaum and others, right? And I think a really good proponent of this way of thinking is Peter Paul Verbeek, right? And he has this notion, and here's how he describes it. He says, "I will defend the thesis that ethics should be approached as a matter of human technological associations. When taking the notion of technological mediation seriously, claiming that technologies are human agents would be as inadequate as claiming that ethics is solely a human affair." Right? He doesn't want instrumentalism, but he doesn't want full machine rights and responsibility. He wants something down the center. He wants a middle position. And Deborah Johnson, more recently, has also articulated this position. She says the following. She says, "When computer systems behave, there is a triad of intentionality at work. There is the intentionality of the computer system designer, the intentionality of the system, and the intentionality of the user." Now, this proposal also has its advantages and disadvantages. In particular, it appears to be attentive to the exigencies of life in the 21st century. None of us, in fact, make decisions or act in a vacuum. We are always and already tangled up in networks of interactive elements that complicate the assignment of intentionality, agency, and moral status. And these networks always include others, not only other human beings, but institutions, organizations, and even machinic technological elements. This combined approach, however, still requires that we decide what aspects of agency and responsibility belong to the machine and which aspects should be attributed to the human being. In other words, the hybrid approach, although tempting to strike a balance between instrumentalism and machine morality, will still need to decide between who counts as a moral subject and what can be considered a mere object. And to make matters even more complicated, this moral framework permits us to shift responsibility around in ways that are oftentimes capricious and inconsistent. And this gets to be very difficult when we're engaged with answering the question, who's responsible for something? So operators on the ground, for example, can instrumentalize their own involvement and deflect responsibility up the network by claiming they were just following orders. This was, as I'm sure you already know, what happened at the Nuremberg trials, right? The soldiers on the ground said, "It's not us, just following orders, it's the higher-ups." And so they instrumentalized their own position and blamed upwards into the network. Conversely, though, upper-level management can always shift responsibility down the network and make the soldier on the ground or the individual on the ground the bad apple. This happened with the Bush administration, with the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. Right? They tried to make it stick to the Bush folks, and the Bush people said, "No, it's not us, it's some bad apples." And so four soldiers went to prison. That's it for a massive scandal, right? and that's because they shifted responsibility off management, off the administration, and pushed it into the lower ranks, the opposite direction from the Nuremberg. Right? Nuremberg goes up, this goes down. Finally, because these networks are often dense and complex, responsibility can be shifted around to such an extent that no one is responsible. This is what occurred with the recent financial crisis. The bundling and trading of mortgage-backed securities was so complex that when they sorted out all the problems and figured out what went on, nobody was held accountable. In fact, nobody went to prison for the financial crisis. The bankers got scot-free, the banks got money and got away scot-free, and as a result, in the final analysis, people lost millions of dollars. No one was responsible. It just evaporated. Now, obviously, these three options define, as I told you, a continuum. And it's a continuum that has very differing views from one end to the other. And I've tried to identify this with this thing I call the machine question, because it's a question. It is a question that we have to debate and ultimately decide in the face of these new kinds of technological challenges. Who we decide to include in the community of moral subjects and who we decide to exclude from the community of moral subjects is going to be an increasingly important decision, because it will decide the future of not only legal liability, but also moral accountability and the state of ethics in the 21st century. Now, I recognize leaving you with a question is bad form, right? Because you're supposed to give all the answers at the end. And then we go away with this warm feeling. Oh, yeah, okay, cool. Right? When you end with a question, it's a bit disturbing. And I take it on good authority that this is what philosophy is about. Because philosophers as different as Martin Heidegger, G.E. Moore, Daniel Dennett, and Slavoj Žižek have all at one time or another said the role of philosophy is not to give answers. The role of philosophy is to figure out what we're asking about. It's to examine the questions and ask, are we in fact even asking the right questions to begin with? This actually goes way back to Plato, right? But it also, you can see it in Kant, right? The first critique is all about, am I asking the right questions? And how do I get to the right questions? So here, I think Žižek says it very well. He wrote a little piece back in 2006 where he says, the task of philosophy is not to provide answers or solutions, but to submit to critical analysis the questions themselves to make us see how the very way we perceive a problem is an obstacle to its solution. As a result of that, my goal today has been simply this, to demonstrate how and why we typically perceive the moral problems of technology might in fact be the obstacle to our solution. In other words, I want to challenge the usual way of thinking about technology and ethics by asking the machine question and getting us to take seriously the machine question in our work. It's by asking this question that we have the best chance of surviving the robot apocalypse. So, that's all I have. Thanks. Oh, sorry. And let me say, we have time now for discussion, questions, whatever, but I know how this works because I've been in this situation myself. You walk out of here and, like, down the hall, on the steps, maybe on the tram going home, that's when the good question occurs to you. It's like, I should have asked that question. If you have that experience, email me. I'm just happy to continue this in whatever form we can. Because I realize, you know, asking you to perform right now may be difficult, and you may need to, you know, ruminate on it. And if you do, great. I'm happy to respond at any time in the future. So, thanks.
Okay. So, I propose to first open up the floor for questions for students, as it's customary here. And then after five people or so, we can open it up to the rest of the audience. Yeah. So first, students of the course and other students coming in. Are there any questions? I'm sure there are a lot.
Yes, for example, I'm saying we already live in this robot apocalypse. My question is, how many, do you have any numbers, how many, for example, of this microchip where have already been sold around the world?
Yeah. So I don't know on the statistics on Jibo. I only know that when they took pre-orders, it sold out in less than 24 hours. They're shipping now, and we will have Jibos supposedly in our world shortly. I don't know how many there's going to be, but I think there's even a better way to demonstrate this. If you ask the Obi-Wan Kenobi question, where are the droids you're looking for? These are the droids you're looking for. We already have our social robot. It's in our pocket and our purse. and it goes everywhere with us, and we rely so much on this. Now, it doesn't move around like we expect robots to do from science fiction, but this is already a kind of social robot. Obama said this in his recent conversation with Wired. I don't know if you saw this. It was like a week or two ago. He had a conversation with Wired magazine, and he said, you know, what he thinks is going to happen is this stuff is just going to slowly move into our world, and one day we'll just wake up and say, where did all the robots come from? So the robot apocalypse won't be like the science fiction movies with, you know, the Cylons attacking us, right? It'll be like the fall of Rome. We're going to invite these things into our house, into our sphere of influence, and one day we'll wake up and we'll wonder, where did all the barbarians come from? And, you know, they're already here.
I suspect you have shares in Jibo.
No, I don't. It's not a public company, so you can't buy shares, unfortunately.
Next question.
I saw the interview on AlphaGo when they asked the Google engineer why did AlphaGo make this move, and he had to delay answering because he had no explanation. And I'm thinking of when organizations develop these new entities to express or to use their power, how will they be able to use their power when they are not able to explain what goes on inside their, in this case, tool? So how can you use your power by means of such a new entity?
Right, that's a good question. So what's interesting is AlphaGo is just a game. So if something went wrong with AlphaGo, okay, not a big deal, right? But what happens when the same systems are controlling the self-driving car? Or doing some other thing that has, you know, life and death consequences. And that's going to happen. I mean, Google didn't do this just to play Go, right? They're doing this in order to roll out some bigger technology. And, you know, the self-driving car is one of the things they're really invested in. And the difficulty is if the engineers can't anticipate everything that can go wrong, then we have to wait until something goes wrong? And that seems a bit disturbing. This is what happened with financial trading systems, right? The algorithms that trade on Wall Street. We don't know that something's going to go wrong with them until something does go wrong. And then what's the solution? Yank the plug. And then try to reverse engineer what happened. But even if you could pry open the lid on the black box, in machine learning systems, there's no coding instructions to follow. So there's no way to sort of reverse engineer what occurred. And so what a lot of industry experts are saying now is before these things are released into the wild, I mean your world and my world, they need to play a lot in the sandbox. And we need to shake out these problems in the sandbox by letting them just screw up again and again and again until we get it right. It would have been nice if Tay played in the sandbox for a while. Right? Releasing her on Twitter turned out to be pretty devastating with regards to, you know, the kinds of things that she was tweeting. But that's the best, you know, that's the best answer we're getting now. And, you know, if you're a moral philosopher, you're like, oh, God, that's not enough. If you're an attorney, you're like, it's not enough, but thank God. Because it means, you know, you're going to be employed for a very long time.
Okay, there was a question.
Yeah, I have another question, rather a critical philosophical reflection on Jibo.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the example. Maybe the problem with thinking about the robots is that sometimes we don't really understand what people actually do. For example, we were demonstrated as Jibo made some reminded something, or he made a photo, but all these things are actually also made by humans. And humans, in when they do this, they are instrumental. So Jibo doesn't make anything human, actually, because he just takes over some actions that are instrumental per se. So it's rather an argument that Jibo is rather way left to the scale, not as a slave, because slave is already a very laden word. Yeah? It's ethically laden. It's mm-hmm. it's just an instrument. It's not neutral.
Yeah. Right. And that sounds really good, but my worry is what are we going to do with these things? Oh, sorry. So we're talking about Jibo as just being another instrument, right? That Jibo is made by human beings to do things that human beings tell Jibo to do, and as a result, we can just apply the instrumental theory to Jibo and not have to worry about what Jibo is doing or not doing. I think from a designer's perspective, that's a really good argument. From a user's perspective, that's really complicated. Because we do things with our technology that the designers never intended. Let me give you another example, just by way of you know, counterexample. In Iraq and Afghanistan, the soldiers have these things called PackBots. They're built by iRobot, the same people who build the vacuuming robot, right? And the PackBot is just a really industrial-looking thing. It's not cute, it's not cuddly, it's not friendly, it doesn't talk to you, it has no personality. It's just a stinking robot. But the soldiers name them, they risk their lives to keep them out of harm's way, and when the robot dies, they have funerals. Now, iRobot tells the soldiers, it's just a stupid instrument, but it doesn't change the way the robots and the soldiers interact on the battlefield. I think once you get something in your home that starts talking to you and is very interactive, like a Jibo, it's going to be hard to just say, well, it's just an instrument. It's going to challenge that category in ways that the users are going to have to deal with, just like the soldiers have to deal with their PackBots.
Yes, in the back. And
correct. Yeah, no, I would agree. I think the answer sometimes from designers is, well, let's just not make them cute, and then people won't like them. You don't have to make them cute for people to like them. What makes us like them is just their interactiveness with us. So in Aarhus last week, Wendy Ju was there. She's from somewhere in California. Stanford, sorry. And she has a robot that's an ottoman. And it rolls out, and it comes up to you, and then you're able to put your feet on it to relax. But people pet it, people talk to it, people worry that putting their feet on the ottoman is going to harm it. And it's just a box. It has no features at all. No face, no expression. It just moves as a box. And the very fact that it moves leads people to go beyond instrumentalizing it. They give it a personality. Some people name their iRobot vacuum cleaners. Right, and they, in fact, there's one guy who I heard leaves crumbs for it because he's afraid it's hungry. It's a vacuum cleaner, right? So you're right. It has nothing to do with the look of the robot. It has to do with social function, and therefore, I always say to my students, it's not about the robot. It's about us. It's about what we do in relationship to these things. Yeah, this is good. We don't have to start anywhere new because Descartes already started there. Descartes' philosophical anthropology begins with the machine. After he says cogito ergo sum, and he knows he's a thinking thing, he looks outside and he says, so how do I not know all those other things out there aren't just machines? How do I know they also say cogito ergo sum? So beginning already with Descartes, the machine is made an instrument of human self-understanding. And I think the fact that now we're at another age where the machine is an instrument of human self-understanding is just a legacy of the modern Enlightenment way of thinking.
Yeah, neighbor.
Robots should be slaves. Maybe that is not possible. case, maybe if we would try to enslave them, there will be voices that will defend their rights.
No, I think you're right.
Simply not possible to enslave them.
Yeah, and Joanna, who I know very well, in her article, in her essay, she sort of issues almost moral imperatives. Like, thou shalt not create cute things. Thou shalt not fall in love with your robot. So it's sort of like an asceticism, right, for the 21st century. But the problem is asceticism doesn't get us very far. As soon as you start prohibiting things, guess what people do? Thou shalt not smoke marijuana. Okay, that worked really well, right? And I think the robot is a really good example. You can tell people not to do it. You can say, it's irrational to do that, but we do irrational things all the time. And I think it's better for our moral philosophy to be in touch with reality than to exist up here in some sort of platonic heaven and pretend that we can sort of legislate these things from on high. So I think you're exactly right. Yeah.
Was a question in the back?
You know, I'm going to walk back so I can hear better, okay? Is that all right?
So, this is a hard one because
can you repeat
these things
it?
Are so damn convenient.
Could you repeat the question because we didn't hear.
Sorry, I'll do it from up here. So it's a question of, you know, why are we letting the robots do this?
We're offloading or uploading or offshoring all of our capabilities to the robot. So why would we do that? You know, shouldn't we just stop from, or is there something we can do individually to stop that movement? And the problem is that these technologies are so convenient and so efficient that they seduce us into giving away things, right? Who remembers phone numbers anymore? This thing does it. I don't even know my parents' phone number, right? So I just rely on my external brain to do that work for me. I get this from my students who are journalism students. Right now we have programs that can write original stories for publication. You don't need journalists. As a result, you can pump out large amounts of stories on financial data, on sports, on even politics, just by downloading data from the cloud, plugging it into an algorithm, and the algorithm spits out a human-readable story. And the journalism students are like, why are we even doing this? And the bottom line is the bottom line. It's cheaper to get rid of your humans. And if you look at what people are investing in, since the financial collapse, business revenues are way up. But guess what isn't up? Employment. And that's because it's easier to buy capital, i.e. algorithms and robots, than it is to invest in human beings. So the, you know, statistics on human unemployment due to automation are, you know, depending on who you talk to in the world of economics, it doesn't look good. Two Oxford researchers about 3 years ago predicted that, 48% of all jobs in the U.S. will be automated in a decade. That's a lot of employment. And the really bad news, the really bad news is that those jobs are not the heavy labor jobs of manufacturing. Those jobs are the middle management jobs, the jobs that most of you when you graduate would hope to get. So we're getting a hollowing out of the middle of the spectrum. So we'll have a lot of really good paying jobs for people who are machine learning data scientists and a lot of really crappy jobs for people who do really, you know, crappy kinds of things like get coffee and do other service jobs. And the middle is going to be the thing that's gone. And that is the worry of most economists right now. Right.
I don't know who remembers Tamagotchi. Tamagotchi is my son was really a living guy and terrified from the flying and work. So it developed a very close emotional kind of relationship to that toy. And that happened even before. I mean, you can have developed a very close to that emotional relationship to other toys, as all of us know. And also adults have emotional relationship to their violins, or to their guns, or to many things. Yeah? So that is nothing new in that. I think it gives just a little bit of the flavor of what the robot can look like, but it doesn't tell really.
Oh, I would agree. I mean, I think the moral questions are the principle. No, but, yeah, and I use Jibo because I just got a nice video for Jibo, right? I could have used Pepper, I could have used Now, I could have used any other social robots that are being developed. I could have used Leonardo, which they developed at MIT. There's all kinds of social robots that are being rolled out and are going to be increasingly available. But let me just point out, I think a lot of really serious things happen from toys. For example, the first personal computer was a toy. The Apple I was a kit sold at the back of popular electronics magazines for hobbyists who were building toys. The Mitz Altair, sold also in the same magazines, was considered a toy computer. In fact, in one of its advertisements, it is called the toy computer. These things at one point were considered, you know, playthings. In fact, a lot of our kids consider them playthings. When I get this out, my kids are like, yeah, here, give me that. Right? This is like the pacifier now. I think a lot of serious stuff happens out of toys. So we shouldn't dismiss toys as just playthings. Right? I think we can look at toys as being the place in which a lot of this stuff is worked out prior to it becoming a commercial product that is a much more serious kind of thing in our world.
Janina?
Yeah, thank you for the talk, and it's actually a comment on what you replied to the student in the back before the last question. It was a question about why don't we start to give up such all these competencies to technologies? And I think it's a difference. We have to decide on what we really give up in all of these cases. For example, the case of the GPS. Just because we always use GPS to navigate from A to B, that doesn't mean that we are not able anymore to get from A to B without GPS. Or the example that you mentioned, that we don't remember phone numbers. That doesn't mean that we are not able to remember numbers anymore just because we use smartphones to remember them for us.
Right.
And that's actually, I think, a crucial point here, that just because we use technologies doesn't mean that we completely give up competencies and capabilities. And the second thing is, I would like to mention that even if there would be some competencies that we really give up in using technologies a lot. That doesn't mean that these competencies are really crucial or essential. I mean, people use technologies for like thousands of years, and a couple of hundred years ago, they could ride a horse. Now, no one is able to ride a horse anymore, but all of them like ride cars, drive cars. So we, dependent on the technologies we develop and we use, we have certain capacities and capabilities we develop as well, and that we give up when we don't use the technologies any longer. So the second point would be, even if we give up certain capacities, are they really crucial capacities, like essential capacities for us as human beings? That's actually...
Okay, good. No. And you know what the oldest story of this is? I mean, this narrative is old. It goes all the way back to Plato's Phaedrus. Right? Because in the Phaedrus, that's the first recorded debate about technology. Because what's new technology for the Greeks? Writing. Right? Oral culture, you get writing, it's a brand new technology. And Phaedrus and Socrates have a huge debate about the impact of writing. And Socrates is all worried that we're going to rely on writing and lose our memory. Well, we didn't lose our memory. And we figured out writing. In fact, if people write now, it's a good thing. Right? It's not somehow a threat to civilization. So you're right. This has been, I think, posed as a zero-sum game. It's never been a zero-sum game. And we have to look back to the Phaedrus, I think, for some guidance on why it's not a zero-sum game and how to get some traction on this. Plato's always right. You know that.
Janina, do you want to take this chair? So Janina will chair the further discussion. I think the next one was Wessel.
Thank you. Yeah, Wessel.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to continue a little bit on the point that was made in the back about... I totally agree with the view of technology that you present, and about the questions that, for me, count as like the questions of technology that are very crucial to ask. What I am skeptical about is the special position that is... I'm not saying that you did it per se, but that's often done when discussing AI and robots as... being a special sort or a special kind of technologies that we have to discuss for different reasons. For example, this one of the arguments has already been named in the sense that we anthropomorphize many different technologies. So, for example, in the Netherlands, we always make the joke that for German men, their car is their second wife. secondly, about the understanding. So I work with people that also work with neural networks, and it is indeed true that they don't understand everything that goes on in there, even though they do understand something of it. But that can also be said about the engineers that worked on the first steam engines, for example, because they didn't know the theory of the thermodynamics yet. So that's the second point. And the third point, more focusing on AI, which is a minefield, of course. When thinking about neural networks and deep learning, the question... So one of the things you said during the presentation that I didn't agree with is that Go learns in a way as we do. There is some quite strong argument against that, whereas all these learning algorithms, they depend on big data analysis. So in a way, you're not only playing against Go, but you're also playing against the history of Go playing, so to say. So you're playing against models of expert Go players as such. So that kind of changes the story. There's also one story that goes about, for example, the way that picture recognition, so face recognition works in deep learning algorithms, which is very different from the way that humans recognize objects. Whereas, for example, if a computer recognizes, or if an algorithm recognizes a cat picture, it recognizes it because it has access to a database with millions and millions and millions of pictures with the objects, depicting objects that are cats. With human learning, we can observe one instance of a cat and then recognize the same object over and over again. So there are strong differences between those types of learning, and also in the computer science community, the consensus at the moment, as far as I read, is that as long as these things can only be implemented on Turing machines, we won't get real artificial intelligence.
Right. So
those are the points.
Let me work backwards. No, totally agree with the last comment, and I had to use some shorthand because we don't have enough time to go and spend a lot of time in deep learning. I mean, we could, but we wouldn't be out of here yet. We'd still be talking about it. And there are differences in the way that human learning takes place and machine learning takes place, big differences. Nonetheless, what I want to get at is the moral component of the result of that, not the actual functionality of it, right? But don't kid yourself. The fact that we got machine learning doesn't mean we have artificial general intelligence. What we got are a bunch of dumb machines, right? All these things do is apply algorithms to big data. What is the big innovation in AI in the last decade is the fact that we now have this massive amount of data that we didn't have before that is now able to be processed and made computable by these learning algorithms. And so that is what really is the big factor here. It's the big data, not some sort of new artificial intelligence capability. It's the same old stuff we've been doing all along, just applied to a brand new set of data that we didn't have at our disposal in the last decade. Now is available at places like Google and Facebook. I mean, you know this. When you're on Facebook, right, everything you do feeds the AI. Every picture you upload, every like you click, every post you make, you are training the AI. Every time you use Gmail, you are training the AI, right? Because the terms of service says that they can read your mail. Then they do, right? And that's how they train their AI. So you are feeding the big data every time you use any application that allows for them to collect personal data. And Facebook, Google, Instagram, you name it, they're all gathering data from us and then using that data either for us or against us, depending on how you want to look at it. To your second point, one of the things that really concerns me is not what the engineers know or don't know. I mean, when you talk to the engineers involved in deep learning, they're, you know, really engaged in trying to grapple with a lot of these questions of where their ability to know falls off and what its limitations are. But I'm really worried about how they explain that to the public or how their corporation explains it to the public. So the engineers may know more, but the corporation is using their lack of knowledge to get away with something. So Microsoft is able to get away from the responsibility of the hateful tweets by saying, well, our engineers don't know what's going on, not the problem, not our problem, okay, your problem. And I think that's a dodge. Mm. And I think it's a really difficult thing for us to grapple with morally. I think it's a real challenge. But I think we're going to see more and more of that, just like we do with the customer service rep who, you know, displaces to the machine. I think machine learning is just another really convenient excuse. Lastly, AI especially, yeah. I think one of the problems in all this debate is that we sort of filter off AI as some sort of special category. But, I mean, we do this with our violins. We do it with our guitars. We do it with our cars. We do it with, I don't know, a stuffed animal. And, therefore, it's not necessarily about sophisticated technology. It's about us and how we interact with our things that are, I think, the important questions.
The person with the pink hair?
A little bit. Can you a little louder? Okay. Let me walk back then. It'll be easier for me then. That's all right.
Okay. Go ahead.
So,
design is all
about
they're exactly
So it's a question about design and about the importance of design. That we can create things that are functional and allow people to utilize them the way they want to. But really good designers know, even before the users know, something about usability and something about interactivity. And so I think a lot of what comes out of this sort of work, especially in social robotics, is the absolute necessity of good design. I think designers often are like an afterthought. Not everywhere. I mean, one of the things that makes Apple products really sexy is design is first, right? They really think about the design of their product. This can't be said for the Lenovo or any of those other, you know, laptops that are pretty hard to use, right? Whereas, you know, I think design needs to be forefronted as a actual, not just an important skill, but a very useful way of thinking about the engagement with our things. And designers have been doing this for decades, you know, for centuries. And that needs to be taken into account, definitely. I would agree.
Since we have 15 minutes left and I have still 5 people on the list, I would ask you to please formulate the comments and questions a bit shorter. Next is the guy at the one in the blue
screen. There's one thing that is strange for me. It is that there will be more and more technical agents which are not visible as agents.
Yes.
So this Internet of Things, this machine condition, is an interesting.
Yeah, no, in fact, when people talk about robots, I think the problem is when we hear the word robot, we think of a physically embodied thing. And that allows us to dismiss all the invisible robots. I think software algorithms are going to be by far the majority of what is making decisions about our world and our lives and affecting us in ways that we don't even recognize. So I think you're exactly right. So much of the decision making for us currently and in the future is going to be invisible stuff. Your refrigerator is going to talk to your car is going to talk to your house, and they're going to make decisions about what you're having for dinner or something. I don't know. But it's going to be this kind of stuff. And that is, I think, important to grapple with. But invisible things are hard to make visible, right? I think so. One of the critical roles for academics in the future is going to be helping to make things visible so that we know what's going on.
And this is actually very much linked to what you just said now about the refrigerator talking to the car and so on. And because if you consider like artificial intelligence on like in a stronger sense, maybe that in a sense that they can talk to each other, etc., etc. What would like the question that I want to get at, making sure, is the question of some sort of self-awareness, maybe? Or of, like, in that direction and about, in the end, about subjectivity.
Right.
Because that's what wanted to go into all the way, but, like, the connection of self-awareness and subjectivity and in that sense.
So usually the way that we deal with these, the way we deal with these moral and social questions is we say, okay, well, yeah, someday we're going to have to think about robots and responsibility and rights when they're aware. We're nowhere near that time, so we can just sit back, develop these things, not worry about it. It's not my problem. We can just sort of delay, and we can delay however far in the future we need to. Some futurists say 5 years, some say 50 years, some say 500 years, so it's anyone's guess as to when that might be. I think that's a really irresponsible position, because I don't think we need subjectivity for these things to have a social effect. They don't need to be self-aware for them to screw up my life. Right? It's because we assume they do things. It's because we project on them various mind states, various emotional conditions, various possibilities. And it's that projection that we make that's the problem. And we're going to do it. We just do it. So they can be really dumb things, but they can have really devastating consequences. And I'd rather think about that than worry about 500 years from now when they're self-aware. Although I'm hoping when they reach that, they look at that picture of me holding the robot rights signs and they say, oh, he's one of the good ones. Spare him.
Person with the great pullover, yeah.
Thank you. You have this slide with the different philosophers who you all say philosophy is not about answers, but about questions. Of course, Marx was not on that side because Marx had a different point of view on that because he was more advocating that philosophy should get its hands dirty in a way and enter into political practice.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you had a few points where you mentioned political issues or how we can perhaps deal with that problem, that political problem which we are talking about, because it is a political problem with robot innovation. So one of the points you made is that one should control before a product comes to the market whether that is harmful or not. And I just wanted to mention that in the European Union, we have a precautionary principle, which is exactly that, which says that no product should come to the market which hasn't been tested for its harmfulness. Whereas in the US, this doesn't exist. There's a debate between the two economic powers, which is also playing a role in TTIP. So there are political things which we can do, perhaps, to at least... perhaps not solved, but there are some elements of the solution to that problem. The other point is technology assessment. You remember that in the US there had been an office of technology assessment, which had been closed by, by the Republican Party in the Senate. So already 20 years ago there was a consensus that technology is not something only for the big companies, but should be controlled democratically. This instrument, which existed, has been removed and doesn't exist anymore. It's a second political answer which would be possible to overcome that problem. Third point, of course, you mentioned the internet of your multinationals, and I discussed it now again, control through Trump. Is not socialization called one problem during the time, during the days of socialism, making big companies a social, controlled by the private society, democratic control on such companies. Is that not a solution which we should advocate in order to at least put some
So, in the interest of time, let me answer more so your first... let me answer your first and second. The third, I don't want to start spinning out policy. I think that could be a policy, but we have to look at what that policy looks like. But with regards to your first and second point, I understand that that's a political question, but I actually think it's more of a question of legal system as opposed to political system. So the legal system in the EU is different than the legal system in the US. So in the EU, most law is statutory law, except in the UK, but they're Brexiting, so they're no longer a problem, right? But like in Germany especially, most law is statutory law. It's top-down, right? You have to come up with the law first and apply it. In the US, we have the tradition of common law, which comes from the UK, in which we wait for things to go wrong, and then the courts sort it out. And the law bubbles up from the bottom. So one of the things that's interesting right now is most of the conferences I go to about robots and responsibility and about AI and ethics and all that stuff is happening in Europe. It's not happening in the US. Because in the US, we're thinking to ourselves, not our problem. Nothing's gone wrong yet. When something goes wrong, then you come and talk to us. We'll get the lawyers involved and the courts will sort it out and we'll get our laws. But it's because the EU has to have the laws in advance. And it has to do with the legal structures more so than it has to do with political structures.
Person on the left side of the room with the glasses.
Thanks for the talk. This is more than the question, and I'll try to make sure it works. I think it's important. This is maybe a point that you have different ideas of what a robot is.
Especially in social robotics. It's
No, it's a good point. I mean, Cynthia Brazil says, you know, the whole point of social robots is to create a robot that we respond to like another person. And in her mind, embodiment's crucial because other people are embodied, and so we interact with each other interpersonally through embodiment. I think what you're pointing to is the fact that we are groping around for vocabulary. We don't even have the right range of words to describe all the things we're trying to get a handle on. And robot is far too general. And that makes us a bit confused when we describe and discuss these things. Because sometimes you're in a debate in which one person is talking about a robot and they mean this by robot, and another person means this by robot, and we're sort of like in a Wittgensteinian nightmare, right, where everybody has their own language. And I think some common terminology here could really help, but it's going to be a while before that gets sorted out, because I don't know that we're anywhere near that.
I wanted to ask about a comment on big data as a reliable source of knowledge, and how big data as a thing that is generated in the past can be a predicament of what will come in the future and how people should behave.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think we should just rely on big data as being somehow valid and operational just because it's big data, right? There needs to be some sort of... This is another you know, crucial social problem. We have the big data, we're using it, but who's watching how it's being utilized? Who's watching how it's being collected? We don't know. It's behind proprietary paywalls, right? The data that Facebook collects on us, we can't look at. Yet it is about us. And we give that privacy away, we give that ownership away. So I think there's a lot to do with regards to the political question having to do with who owns the big data, who gets to manipulate it, and how do we test it. So I would never assume that it would be valid just in and of itself as big data. I do think we need mechanisms to engage in the question of validation. We just don't have them.
Two questions left according to my list. First, the lady with the glasses, and then the bloody Borrello. Well, you got the shirt, right?
Distinct characteristic.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And I think Don Ida says it very nicely when he says, we don't have a philosophy of the quasi-other. We have a philosophy of things. We even have the new object-oriented ontology, right? It's all about things. And we have the philosophy of the other subjects. And we've done really well with that stuff. But our theorizing has never grappled very adequately with the quasi-other. And I think Ida is somebody who calls for a philosophy of the quasi-other. And it's, I think, our task from this point forward to really develop this. So good news for you guys. Job opportunities, right? But let me just say another thing about this. Stuff in the middle, the problem with it is it migrates from one side to the other based on which way the wind is blowing sometimes. So, for example, dogs used to be property. And they were things. You could dispose of them as you wish. Like when my grandparents had a dog that was misbehaving and wouldn't hunt anymore, guess what they did? Take it out back and shoot it. Because it's an object, it's like a refrigerator. When it stops functioning, you get rid of it. So they had a dog, it was a poor hunter, it was gun shy, took it out back, shot it, got a new dog. Because it was a tool to get the job done of hunting birds, right? Today, that seems absolutely barbaric. Because dogs are now getting closer to another person. In fact, there's a new law in Oregon in the United States where dogs are now given the rights of people. Law just passed about a few months ago. Did the dog change? Has the dog evolved in that short period of time to become something it wasn't? No, it's the same goddamn dog. Right? Evolutionary speaking, it's the same dog. What's changed is us. So when I go to my, like my vet, I am no longer a dog owner. I am now called a pet parent. Which is a really weird turn of phrase. But it's about the status change of the dog. It's now seen as a fuzzy child. Right? And that's a big change. But it's a social change, right? It's not a change in the animal. It's a change in how we relate to the animal. That's why I say a lot of this is about us and not about the object.
I don't know if you mentioned this, so if you did, I apologize in advance. But supposedly, you have Google Car, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have the trolley problem. And what happens if you put the Google Car in the trolley problem? Who is it to decide whom the car runs over, right?
Yeah, right.
So there's this question of programming the morality within the car itself, right? And the second thing is, we can't allow humans. Humans are broad, right, with their opinions. So we have feminists, we have chauvinists, and so on, so on, so on. But we cannot allow this wide span of morality for the robots themselves, right? So wouldn't it be beneficial for us to have some sort of a general rule book or agreement amongst humans? What kind of moral behavior do we expect from robots themselves?
So, in fact, Isaac Asimov thought of this, right? His three laws of robotics. I mean, that kind of was, you know, the agreement we all had about how the robot should behave. Now, it turns out you can't make them computable, so it doesn't really work. But, nonetheless, it was, you know, at least fictionally speaking, a kind of brokered deal among humanity about what we're going to allow our robots to do and not do. I think right now, the fact that you see all of these papers being written, all these books being written, all these conferences going on about these questions shows you that, yeah, we're kind of thinking this through. Whether it spits out a rule book, I don't know. But it at least opens up the question to interrogation and makes it important. I'll just say one last thing about the trolley problem. I wish they didn't call it the trolley problem. I mean, it's an important problem, right? It's a classic moral question. But when I tell my students, you know, the Google car has a trolley problem, my students don't know what a trolley is. Because they've never seen one. And so I got to when you got to explain the metaphor, it no longer works, right? And so you get in this really bad situation where the trolley is like a train, but it's not a train. It's on the train. It's like, okay, they forget it. So the trolley problem is already a problem.
Okay, thank you very much, David Gunkel, for the inspiring talk. Thank you guys for posing all these questions. And to encourage what you already started with, please send him your ongoing questions and your comments and whatever, and you will be happy to answer them, I think so. Thank you all very much, and see you next week.